Zoom because you're going to make a presentation and Commissioner Fish can catch up to us. So let's return to order, and would you read 1147, please, Sue?
1147. Accept report on the first year results of the CityCorps Chronic Disease Management Program, Healthy Foundations.
Good morning and welcome.
Great. Thank you, Mayor Hales, Commissioners. Anna Kenwit, Director of the Bureau of Human Resources. With me today is Kathy Bless, who's the manager of the Benefits and Wellness Office, and Dr. Neil Mills, who's the Medical Director for MOTA, and also Rod Hart, who's the Director of Healthcare Services for MOTA. It is with delight, actually, more than pleasure, that we are here to provide you with a report on the first year results of the CityCorps Chronic Disease Management Program called Healthy Foundations. The program is a collaborative effort by the Benefits and Wellness Office and MOTA Health. And I am going to turn it over to Kathy Bless, who's going to review the first year results, and then we are simply asking you to accept that report. Thank you. Kathy?
Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning. Thank you, Anna. Kathy Bless, Benefits and Wellness
Bring
Manager.
Bring that microphone over. There you go.
Certainly. This program is possible because of the partnership with MOTA. Dr. Mills, Rod Hart, and the extended MOTA team are incredibly dedicated, innovative, and collaborative folks. Sally Hill and Joel Michaels are also here representing MOTA today. They helped us create this unique opportunity within the city, and I'm very grateful for that. The mission of Healthy Foundations is to create and sustain opportunities that empower individuals to become their own healthcare advocate. This report today will make clear that we are having some success. We're on large claims data. In the plan year ending June of 2013, we had 380 people using $20 million in healthcare at an average per person cost of $54,000 each. In fact, since I've been the benefit manager, our experience for chronic and large claims has been staggering. Nearly 50% of the total dollars spent in the last 5 years are for less than 5% of the participant population. In taking a closer look at this data, it also showed that high-risk participants costs were increasing by 43%, using their primary care physicians less and using emergency rooms more. In plan year 2010, the highest risk population had 163 visits to the ER, and in plan year 2011, they had 241, a 48% increase. Changing our culture, our behavior, was critical. These individuals struggle with the complexities of their health, and they also struggle with the impact it has on the rest of their lives at home and at work. We are not unique in this statistic, but we needed a new approach. One of the most important and most meaningful ways I began to meet this challenge was to partner with MOTA and create Healthy Foundations. We've been talking and collaborating since. We discussed other successful programs around the country, including patient-centered medical homes, mobile care teams, and hotspotting. We chose to consider the relationship first, to design a unique solution that builds trust and connection as a cornerstone, a solution able to address an individual's barriers to self-advocacy. We spent lots of time talking about what participants experience when they seek services through regular channels. We developed a model that illustrates what we believed was the current reality and what was the ideal. It was up to the participant to be the expert. We expected them to understand everything about how to access the best in-network care at the right time, every detail in a complicated system. We expected some of them to manage all of this while they were really sick, or while one of their loved ones were sick. And now I'm not sitting here trying to suggest that plan participants should not be held to a certain level of self-responsibility. That would be a contradiction to the mission and my intention. But what I am suggesting is that at critical stages, help, support, and building trust are game-changing opportunities that we can't afford to miss. Our first outreach was in October of 2012. Moda sent invitations to 37 folks that we really wanted to connect with. During the first year, there were 255 invitations sent out with a 28% activation rate. For this report, we included 71 participants who were in some stage of the program at the one-year mark. The program enrollment continues to grow. We are learning and improving the data, information, and outreach models. One of the important values we understood from the beginning is that we needed to begin slow to ensure that the most important piece of this type of outreach, the connection, was not lost. We needed to ensure that each person coming into the program got the attention they needed. Since this report was created, we now have a total number of 90 participants and 51 folks in the active stage. About 60% of the participants are women, 40% are men. Participants can be the employee, spouse, domestic partner, or dependent child. 80% of the participants are over the age of 50. In all of these stages, the program is intended to be comprehensive, coordinated, client-centered, and inclusive of a member's family. The disease chart identifies the types of chronic illness that is most prevalent within the Healthy Foundations population. This chart also mirrors what we know of the disease burdens within the city core population. From all the work that has been done to put this program in place and throughout its first year, a profile emerged. Participants for which this program was developed generally have similar issues. They have high chronic disease burden, high cost utilization patterns, failed provider interventions, challenging socio-behavioral life, low trust and self-esteem, wary of payer, provider, and employer involvement, and overwhelmed with priorities and decision-making. It feels a bit overwhelming when you look at all this data, but the CARE team hit the ground running, and the results are great. 59% of individuals who are in the active stage of this program have lowered their risk scores. The Healthy Foundations CARE team are making a difference. The CARE team had nearly 1,400 in-person member meetings in the first year, and they would meet participants wherever there was an opportunity to support, for support and health promotion. They went to their homes, markets, healthy restaurants, medical provider visits and hospital visits, fitness centers, parks, promenades, and other community events. While the city's of Portland's overall emergency claims had a reduction of 11% last year, Healthy Foundation participants had a reduction of 50% and a 37% reduction in cost. We have also seen some encouraging signs regarding inpatient care and positive trends towards a shorter length of stay. 44% of active members had reduced costs per member per month. 41% of active members had reduced outpatient visits, and 32% had decreased specialty visits during active engagement. We did see an increase in preventive care and an increase in the cost of those services. We also saw a 38% increase in other specialty visits like complementary care, psychologists, dermatology, during active participation.
That's a cost per member in that graph on the right?
It is a cost per member, yes.
Okay.
33% of participants increased the number of prescriptions they were taking, and this resulted in a 66% increase in the cost of drugs per member per month in this population. Being compliant with medication is important and can be a significant, can lead to a significant improvement in a person's quality of life. While some folks cost more and some cost less, the overall picture was very positive, with two-thirds of the active group using less benefit dollars and improving their quality of life at the same time. We are doing the right thing. Improving social engagement, depression, pain levels are known to positively affect chronic disease outcomes and conditions like diabetes and cardiovascular disease. Our results show improved self-management, decreased ER use, cost, and increased quality, and that is a great start. The CARE team also found significant improvements in overall depression rates and improved physical capacity for those individuals dealing with chronic pain. Member satisfaction is also very high. All participants who have been in the active stage for at least 6 months feel that the overall experience is positive and they would recommend the program to others. Participants also felt the program was tailored to them, improved their capacity to self-manage, and the Healthy Foundations team cared about them. Future plans include growth and increased participation for sure. Then we also want to add different communication strategies like group meetings, newsletters, and a Healthy Foundations webpage. We also want to include video conferencing for members when it's sometimes hard to meet in person, and also provide group exercise and stress management experiences. We look forward to keeping you informed of our progress. Thank you for the opportunity to come and report to you our success, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thanks. Hear from our partners at MOTA.
Sure. So to very quickly summarize what we've just heard from Kathy here, is this is a hotspotters program where we've identified that top 5% of the healthcare utilizers that are the city core members. And we've developed a special program through trust where we're able to help them use the healthcare system in a much more cost-efficient manner and improve the quality of their life.
And I would just only echo what Dr. Mills just stated in terms of just it's really about the relationship, and it's very much a behavioral-based approach. The disease really is secondary. It's really addressing all the other issues that are typically in people's lives with chronic long-term health problems, whether it's caring for an elderly parent, a disabled child, or others. Oftentimes, the care for the self doesn't happen. They're taking care of other people first. And the intent is to not only impact just that individual, but the entire family unit as a total.
That's great. Questions for the panel?
This is more comment than question, but I just want to stress how proud I am that the city is doing this program. I mean, this is cutting edge stuff. A couple of years ago, Atul Gawande in the New Yorker had an article called "The Hotspotters," and it described a variety of innovations in healthcare. And one thing he highlighted was the Atlantic City Casino Workers Union, which was self-insured, and they adopted a program like this, where they have healthcare coaches doing intensive outreach to the highest healthcare utilizers. And I met with Kathy some months before I took office and was talking about that, and she said, yeah, actually, we're working a program just like that. And several months ago, we invited some representatives of other governments and some corporations to hear a presentation from Kathy and Dr. Mills and Mr. Hart about this program. It included representatives from Precision Castparts, for example, and I think people were very impressed, and some of them said, we're going to go back to our corporate folks and figure out if we should start adopting a program like this. I mean, I think another thing to stress is that traditionally, I think the assumption has been that the way to reduce costs of healthcare for an employer is to dump more of those costs on the employee and raise, you know, copays, raise deductibles. And the fact is that to some extent, those strategies can be counterproductive because you encourage people to avoid care that they need. I mean, as Kathy was saying, you know, medication compliance is actually an important thing. We don't want to deter people from taking the medication they're supposed to be taking. I think this is exactly the kind of thing that we need to be doing to help our employees and their families actually be healthier, to reduce our healthcare costs. And, people who talk about healthcare talk about bending the cost curve. And I think that if we keep on adopting innovative programs like this, we'll be able to bend that curve like Beckham.
Well, Steve, I'm to follow up on that, I just want to observe that ever since they renamed the Rose Garden the MOTA Center, we not only have the Trailblazers gone on a historic run, but for the first time in my memory, the starting five has stayed injury-free for the first 20 games. So I wonder if there's a cause and effect.
They'll take credit for sure. Yeah.
Great. Actually, I do have one question. Kathy, you said that 44% of the active group reduced their per member per month cost, but I think elsewhere there's something that said that 65% of the group had reduced their overall cost, and it was just, can you clarify what's going on in terms of costs?
I can, or Dr. Mills?
Why don't you start and then I'll clarify any points.
So individually, when someone is reducing their own individual costs, they could be using different providers, taking different medications, not going to the emergency room. So they're redirecting their care in very specific areas that are more appropriate.
Yes, that's a really good point. So it was one of the ways we determined success, because we considered what results should look like at the end of the first year when we actually rolled this program out. So we strongly believe that there should be an increase in primary care utilization, number one. And I just wanted to emphasize there was a trend of negative for the overall spend for the entire City of Portland group over this past year. And again, when you're addressing that top 5%, it only takes a small change in the way they utilize healthcare to see that overall negative spend.
Right. So being 44% or 41% that reduced their costs, but then 66% reducing their overall costs, it relates to just how that care is being delivered and the types of services that they had in the prior plan year.
But this program came about after discussions with Labor Management Benefits Committee, is that right?
It came about in the same, yes, with discussions with that group and directly with MOTA.
And this is an example of one of our committees that I'm particularly proud of, that you lead with Anna and this labor management, and everybody's focused on how do we reduce our healthcare costs while at the same time taking care of our employees. So it's a wonderful committee. When did we start looking at establishing this program? When did it actually get going?
So we started in August of 2011, beginning to talk with MOTA. That's why we have a number of statistics from that 2010-11 plan year. And it took about a year and a half to get everything situated, to hire the care team that is specific to this program within MOTA, and to get that program off the ground. So we started very small in October of 2012 with those 37 invitations going out, making sure that we learned from that initial group, making sure that we had the appropriate type of care for them, and as we increased our participation.
It has been a very carefully thought through program, and something I want to highlight for everybody at home, one of the intricacies is about healthcare and confidentiality. So the partnership with MOTA, so that we don't have managers, commissioners in the city government saying, you're not healthy, you need to go do stuff.
Right.
It's very much done with respect for the employee and an offering of services rather than a mandate. And so
confidentiality is extremely important. It's why the care team are part of the MOTA team, not part of the city. I don't know who is on the who is a participant of the Healthy Foundations program unless they self-identify to me because they say thanks. But it was critically important. And even as we looked through data, it was data that was on the aggregate. And profiles were developed, but not on individuals. So we don't get part of what we could report on is a change in productivity in the workplace. We don't do that because that would mean that we would have to know who's on that program, and we don't want to do that. So we do ask them how they feel about their changes in quality in life, but MOTA does through their assessments, but we don't get that data.
First of all, I thank you, Kathy, for your leadership of the healthcare program. You've done an amazing job over the 5 years that I've been working with you. And second of all, I hope that we can figure out how to do our biometric testing with our employees that we had funded with the general fund. I'd have to ask Anna, or maybe ask Andrew Scott from the budget office, whether we're allowed to use healthcare dollars to do that testing. But it seems to me that feedback for employees, I mean, part of this program's success, I believe, is the actual tracking of how are you doing and giving the employee that feedback of when you take your medicine, you feel better. I mean, that it seems like that's a a given, but it's when you're busy trying to get your work done and not necessarily focusing on your own health care, having a team like MOTA helping you track that and then pointing out, you know, you actually haven't been to the doctor as often now being that you're on your meds, those kinds of things. It seems to me if we could expand that to the entire city population, that we could further decrease our health care costs, even if we're just tracking blood work and blood pressure and weight and such once a year. It gives each employee that data, especially if you give them the accumulated data over the last X years yes, I have actually put on a little more weight than I thought, or whatever that might be. So that's just something to consider that I hope the Labor Management Benefits Committee and MOTA might look at as to how we can restore that service.
Can I ask one question off of that? this summer, at the Summer Free-for-All, I got tweets occasionally from a man, Commissioner Fritz, and during the intermission of these shows, she would have people stand and do sort of makeshift exercise to get off the ground and get the blood circulating. And reminds me that we have a lot of great people in the Parks Bureau in our rec centers who are some of our best wellness ambassadors. And I think of someone like Chuck Amato, former Mr. Universe, who's worked with Parks for 50 years and is a guru around diet and exercise. We talk every once in a while when we have these presentations, we come back to this question about would it be cost-effective for us to subsidize the fees that employees pay to be part of a rec center or some other provider to get the regular exercise they need to also reduce their risk factors? Is that something we've addressed, or is that still in the pipeline?
It's still in the pipeline.
And I guess the point is, what Chuck Amato has taught me is that changes in diet, changes in lifestyle make a huge impact on health. And if there's some way we can create incentives for our employees to have access to people like Chuck and make it a regular part of their routine, I'm guessing we'll see some also dramatic health outcomes. And I'd just like to know at some point whether there's a mechanism to do that.
Yeah, I want to second that and look for other opportunities. Now that you've done this for a couple of years, you've got these results, you know it works, then let's look for ways to synergize with this. We do own and operate a set of recreation centers. You know, some of our members patronize other facilities, but we own and operate a chain of recreation centers where our employees could get more fit if they all went there. Mm-hmm. So that seems almost a no-brainer to me that ought to be cost-effective to get them there. I know there's a cost each time somebody walks in the door, so let's figure out how to monetize.
Our fitness facilities at our community centers are the most popular, and they're very well used. There's often a wait for the machines, and the machines wear out. So that you would think that there might be capacity, but it's obvious that people in the community are recognizing that exercise, and particularly the cardiovascular and the weight training, is really good for them at a very short time.
Well, just on that point, though, Commissioner, that My recollection is that when we were looking at specialty programs for the African American Healthcare Coalition and other groups, and we're looking at utilization and access, one of the things I learned is that if you look at the utilization of our rec centers, there are in fact hours of non-peak use, and we could even do some congestion price. We could do pricing that relates to that. But for example, with our employees, we could provide an incentive, but also says, here are the preferred hours when it's off-peak so that we're not bumping up against high utilization areas. And it actually would then justify maybe a lower cost point because it's not getting the same use. And we have that data. So I would say there's probably a way to reconcile the concern you've raised about capacity with access.
All right. And I may have been being cheap simply in referring to our own facilities. It may be cost effective to look at for-profit facilities as well, given the marginal cost of that versus the cost of healthcare. You know, it may still be a huge cost-benefit improvement.
I don't want to lose sight of the fact that, I mean, research has shown, although it's great for people to go to a rec center in a gym and get vigorous exercise, it's also important for people to get exercise in the course of their daily lives. I mean, even people who exercise vigorously 3 times a week, if the rest of their time they're sitting in their chairs, they have negative health outcomes. So I think that we should remind ourselves and our city employees to, you know, we don't want you sitting at your desk for 8 straight hours. Get up and move around every once in a while.
Steve,
it's a good thing.
You were the author of the ordinance on standing.
Exactly, the war on chairs.
And I got a call recently from a guy from New York who's part of a national movement that's trying to encourage signs in buildings like ours that say encourage people to take the stairs,
mm-hmm.
not the elevator. And I said, well, I'll partner with Commissioner Novick on this. So I'm going to come talk to you about that next piece. Yeah.
I also should mention that Katie Schreiber in my office has talked to Kathy about the concept of challenging the county to a pedometer contest this next April, and I'll get back to you on the details of that. But pedometer contests are a lot of fun, and I know that the state legislature has had them over the years, and I know that Jenny Burdick has put in a lot of miles winning that several times. And also, you know, if we're going to do all this collaboration with the county, we should offset it by some competition, and I think pedometer competition would be a good way to do it.
Good enough. Yeah. All the politicians involved, something about walking your talk comes to mind. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good idea.
Great.
Mayor, can I just do a time check on something?
Yes, we got
to. It looks to me like we have potentially another hour worth of council, and we're scheduled to be at the county at 1. Is it?
If we have another hour. I'm not sure that the next item is going to take that long.
But we have 4 things pulled from consent, plus another time certain, plus our regular agenda.
Let's see how much we can get done.
I'm posing the question of whether we might want to bump back the county half an hour, because we're going to finish up, want to have lunch, and then get over there.
Yep. I guess
it's a question.
Reasonable. Anything further for this panel? Thank you very much. Are there anyone else signed up to testify on this? Okay, then I think we can take a motion to adopt the report.
Move to adopt the report.
Second.
Any further discussion? Roll call.
Novick.
Aye.
Fritz.
Thank you again for your work, and thank you for being here today. Aye.
Fish.
Thank you, and thank you for reminding us that these are things that you can begin and address at any age. With some pretty significant results. Aye.
Hales.
Great work. And as the council getting wrapped up in this discussion indicates, you got a lot of support and interest making this an ongoing success story and looking for ways to expand it. Thank you. Great.
Thank you all.
Thank you so much. Aye. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, so let's get a time estimate maybe on the next item, Commissioner Novick.
They've asked for 10 minutes.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So I count 8 items. I just for the sake of our colleagues.
Yep.
Outside the river.
So some of us have an appointment across the river at 1:00.
1:00.
Do you want to go till 12:30? Does that work?
Okay. Let's
see if we can make it.
That would be good.
Item 1148: amend contract with Portland Streetcar Inc. for vehicle engineering services relating to streetcar vehicles being procured from Oregon Ironworks for the streetcar loop project, and increase compensation by $75,724.
Novick.
So this is another installment in the LTK Engineering Services contract. I'm happy to say that Oregon Ironworks What's it called again?
United Streetcar
has delivered the last car. It's in revenue service, but we do need our engineering services contractor to be able to spend some time over the next few months, you know, sort of auditing it and testing it and making sure that it's okay and that it's safe. I do want to spend a couple of minutes addressing the fact that this is an engineering services contract that started off at $1 million and is now close to $2.3 million. And I think people have a right to ask questions about that, and I've asked some questions about that, and I want to share my questions and answers. One question is, does this amendment, does the overall expansion of this contract put us over the overall budget for the Eastside Loop project? The answer is no. The Eastside Loop project is still within budget. In fact, we still have over $1 million left in contingency. Another question that I had was the council ever informed in the past that this engineering services contract might actually exceed $1 million? And what I was told is that, you know, the reason people knew from the beginning that $1 million was a conservative number, this is not a contract for a specific deliverable, this is for services as needed over a period of time. And the decision was made to start with a conservative number, realizing there might be some flexibility, rather than starting with a high number and give people reason to think that they can just spend up to that number. And specifically, when the council approved this contract in February 2010, one of the things in the ordinance was, item 8, the level of competence on compensation to accomplish the work is low. In addition, the parties recognize that additional vehicle engineering services will likely be required if the city approves the request of OIW, manufacturer of the Portland Streetcar Loop vehicles, to substitute the supplier of the streetcar vehicle electrical slash propulsion system. And that substitution was made. That accounts for, I think, about $300,000 of the additional $1.3 million. Another question I think is fair to ask is it the case that, to some extent, the increase in this contract is due to the delays of United Streetcar Inc. in delivering cars? And to a significant extent, we have used more engineering services because of those delays. And that is an issue that is going to be part of our discussions with United Streetcar Inc. when we settle up the contract. And, you know, we appreciate our partnership with Oregon Iron Works United Streetcar Inc. We're proud to be doing business with an Oregon company. But that doesn't change the fact that there have been delays and we've incurred costs resulting from those delays. So the negotiation team knows that this is, you know, we are concerned about the increased costs of the engineering contract, and that has to be taken into account as we go through those negotiations. Another thing I think it's important to point out is this money is part of our part of a project that the federal government is funding 60% of. So the federal government will pick up 60% of the cost of this contract extension. So with that said, turn it over to the team.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Catherine Levine. I work with Portland Transportation. As the commissioner noted, the ordinance specifically authorizes a contract amendment with Portland Streetcar Inc. With me today is the chair of the board of directors of Portland Streetcar Inc., Jim Mark.
Thank you very much. And I think Commissioner Novick did an excellent job of sort of, I guess, rounding the discussion of questions that could come up. So mine's really just to add my support for this. You know, first of all five cars are in service. I know that's been a question that's been raised outside Portland Streetcar and outside this room. So all five cars are in service. All five cars are working. We also expect this the last time we come before City Council asking for additional engineering services. This is it with this contract. The Loop has been an incredibly successful program. It's over 1,000 new residential units are either under construction or finished on the east side. The east side Loop has gone from about 3,600 riders in March to over 5,300 in September, and that side continues to grow and add service for an area that needs that type of service. As Commissioner Novick mentioned, we've still got $1 million in the budget, so we're not over budget. We're over the engineering allotment, but the overall budget is still well intact. And again, we really, you know, we appreciate all the support the city's given in this project. And it's my pleasure to be able to serve in this capacity. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Questions for the team? Thank you both. Thank you. Is there anyone else signed up?
Mark Hoffine signed up.
Mark, you want to speak? Okay. Thank you very much. Further discussion? And then, this is an emergency ordinance, so it's a roll call.
Novick.
Aye.
Fritz.
Thank you for the clear presentation. Aye.
Fish.
Aye.
Hales.
Thank you, Commissioner Novick and team, for bringing it home. Aye. Okay, now we had four items pulled from consent.
No, we got the regular agenda.
Sorry, let's do that first. Yeah, let's do the regular agenda first. 1157,
please. 1157, accept bid of Moore Excavation, Inc. for the Eastmoreland to Woodstock Sewer Rehabilitation Project for $9,672,115.
Good morning, Ms. Moody. How are you? Afternoon, I should say. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Afternoon, Mayor, Commissioners. Christine Moody, Procurement Services. You have before you a procurement report recommending a contract award to Moore Excavation, Inc. for the Eastmoreland Woodstock Sewer Rehabilitation Project. The engineer's estimate for this project was $12 million. On September 10, 2013, four bids were received, and Moore Excavation is the low bidder at $9,672,115. The city identified six divisions of work for potential minority women and emerging small business subcontracting opportunities. Subcontracting participation from Moore at bid time was at 9.5% or $83,438. In subsequent conversations with the contractor, they have committed to increasing the participation to 14.4% at $126,438. They are responsive to the city's good faith effort requirements. I will turn this back over to City Council if they have any questions regarding the bidding process. And Mark Hutchinson is here from the Bureau of Environmental Services to answer technical questions about the project. And Gary Stevens from War Excavation is also here if you have questions of the contractor.
Christine, I have a couple if I could. First of all, it's good news, obviously, that the estimate was $12 million and the bid came in at 9.6. So from a taxpayer point of view, I guess we should celebrate that. And certainly More Excavation has a good track record. The concern that I have, though, is that our aspirational goal is 35% on MWESB. And even under the sort of revised goal that is the result of your continuing conversations with our friends at More, we're only going to get up to about 14.4%. Now, my understanding is that under state law, if they've complied with all of the other requirements of the contract, this is not a basis for us to reject the proposal before us. So that I'm clear on the law. But I guess the question I have is, what else can we do with a very reputable contractor to see if we can boost the participation to get closer to our aspirational goal?
Well, we can work with the contractor throughout the life of the project to increase participation. And it may be something that Gary wants to address if he, Mr. Stevens from Moore, can address as to what they can do to increase their participation.
Mr. Hutchinson, do you, from BES, do you have a view as to what else we could do to try to bring the floor up here?
Yeah, this project is
one of the— Why don't you introduce yourself first?
Oh, I'm Mark Hutchinson. I manage the construction division for the Bureau of Environmental Services. And this is one of the first projects of our program to replace our oldest and aging failing sewers. And the type of work that we're doing in the neighborhood, there's nearly 6 miles of pipeline on this project that's failed or broken. And so we're kind of in a hurry to keep sewage out of people's basements right now or sinkholes in the street. We've bid this project to go and rebuild these sewers in these old neighborhoods in East Moreland. The method that Moore chose is called pipe bursting. We bid the thing to do open cut. We allow people alternatives for pipe bursting, which is similar to tunneling. The challenge with that is that our normal minority participation opportunities are in paving and in trucking. And with this method, we have less paving to do, and we have less trucking of the materials because we're actually digging less materials and removing more from the job site. So one of the challenges with a 35% is that the core work doesn't have these normal items, flaggings and other items. What our plan is, realizing that there's less opportunity on this project because there's less pieces to subcontract out, is to look at things like flagging and to look at some of the different changes that are inherent to this type of work. This is much like when you're remodeling your house, you plan to do a certain scope of work, but as we open the street up and we find voids or we find problems finding people's actual sewers to their houses, there are other opportunities, and the scope tends to expand. We expect to keep those changes within 5% of the contract amount, but we're going to continue to work with Moore on those opportunities. Moore has been a long-time partner with us through the CSO program and has been able to provide those opportunities on previous projects. So our expectation is that they'll continue to work with us as we do this work. It is work that we do need to get moving on because most of these sewers were built in the 1920s and they're in pretty poor shape right now.
Yeah, I was just looking at the report. I mean, you the contractor sent out contacts to MWESB contractors, but only in five categories. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the difference between horizontal construction in a street or on a sewer versus a building where there'd be 25 or 30 subcontractor categories, right? So you just don't have the same number of categories of work, regardless of the construction technique. And then if you're using a construction technique like this, it's specialized, less digging. Yeah, I get it.
And so I also understand, Mayor, that there's a time, there's an urgency in terms of doing the work. But I wonder, since we're looking to continually refine and update our MWESB program, how we best implement our aspirational goals and to adapt to the actual work that we contract, I wonder if we could ask Christine Moody, because there appears to be no basis for us to reject this on this contract on the basis that exclusively on the basis we're talking about. I wonder if you could come back to us and give us some lessons learned and potentially some thoughts about how we could tighten the bolts going forward.
Come back to us on that in the future.
Lessons learned in which way?
And this, as the mayor said, this is a different kind of construction project. That's a different timeline. I would like to have a, maybe not in this forum, but maybe we could talk informally about what are additional strategies we can employ to boost participation in these kinds of projects without holding this one up. I don't want to lose an opportunity here to say, is there something we can learn from this contract that we can do differently or better in the future? And I'm not suggesting you have fallen short, but is there something we could do at a policy level to create more opportunity on contracts like this?
Commissioner, I think there are, as I gave the, I think you were absent a couple weeks ago, I gave the social equity contracting strategy update, and one of those will be looking at policies and procedures around subcontracting. And one of the ideas is looking at a limit of self-performed work by a prime contractor so that there would be additional opportunities for subcontracting in there, which opens up additional MWESB opportunities as well. So that's one of the strategies that we're looking at.
I appreciate Commissioner Fish's questions on this. Excuse me while I expire. May I hear from the Moore Excavation representative who's here? Thank you. And as Commissioner Fish alluded, Moore Excavation has been a good partner with the city over the course of the combined sewer overflow projects and have been with us many times. My question for you is about the minority and women employment within your company. Do you keep track of that?
Oh, yes.
And what level are you at?
We're at about 30%.
Minority combined?
Yes, company-wide, yes.
And do you have a strategy to increase that?
More than 30%?
Mm-hmm.
Well, quite honestly, we thought we were doing quite well at 30%. But
That's true.
I mean, we always have minority outreach for employees, especially under the apprenticeship program. High percentage of our apprentices, probably more than 50% of our apprentices introducing themselves into the workplace are minorities. And we work with the Northwest College, Construction College, on that.
Great. Thank you, because I think that that's another piece of this puzzle. Yes, we want to encourage minority businesses in ownership, but we also want to see the makeup of the employees reflect the makeup of our city as a whole. And you're right, 30% in terms of minorities is better than the city of Portland government is doing. In terms of women, we're probably 50-50. Mm-hmm. It's important to me that we attract more women into the trades and construction industries, and I know that you work with the Oregon Trades Women's Council,
right,
and others to provide,
yeah, yes, we do,
apprenticeship.
Yes.
So I applaud you for that and just, okay, encourage you to do that, and maybe for procurement services and for all of us, that might be something that we could get information on. If the prime contractor isn't registered as a minority or women or emerging small business, can we get the information about how well you're doing on your diversity and supportive efforts? So thank you for that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions? Great. Thank you for the report. I think there's a motion needed
accept the report.
Second.
Further discussion? Oh, no one. I'm sorry. Had anyone signed up to testify?
I did not have anyone, but looks
okay.
Like Charles.
All right. Wilson, so let's let him come up and testify. Thank you all. Sorry, Charles.
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, Charles Johnson, and I normally I'm biased towards Commissioner Novick, but Amanda Fritz gave me the best segue for this topic. So, because this item is sort of being used by the council and myself as an agenda to really apply the equity lens to everything the city does, and If you want to get closer to these aspirational goals, I encourage you to work with your partners, Chairwoman Madrigal and Commissioner Loretta Smith especially. I think to reach those goals, the city and the county need to look towards stronger partnerships with credit unions and Albina Bank to develop good minority and women candidates. I think that's an appropriate role for local government to strengthen its connection with the business community, to have a better pool so that the general contractors can find more women and more minorities who are qualified. And that's all I had. Thanks, Joan.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks. Okay. Crystal, did you sign up on this item? And again, the council's pressed for time, so.
Okay. My name is Crystal Elinsky. I represent 10,000. And I would like to address these issues about lessons learned. That's a very good question. And I'm glad that the Commissioner Fritz is always bringing up the lens of women. And thank you, Charles, for the lens of equity. What I'm always baffled by is the money. And when I see these figures thrown out, like yet another project, and this is just one individual project, and we do have to learn about who we're working with, if these are contractors that use, that we need to always consider unions. We have broken a lot of our city contracts with not using unions. So this is something I always look at as well. But I wonder why everything is sort of piecemeal with our projects and we go along as a city doing the same sort of upgrades and infrastructure when we could include in these plans alternative environmental ways of, for example, with sewage is, you know, I have a friend that has a cesspool and it's really amazing from his description. It reminded me of the book I read during the library's what do they call that every year? Portland Reads, or we read the ghost map about London in the late 1800s and the cesspools. And wow, we have those sorts of, we have unpaved roads in Portland. It's all very quaint. But I think a lot of Portlanders would be interested in finding alternative ways for sewage. We need to have our compost here and not dump it on North Plains and make it their problem. I know Mayor Adams is not, formerly Mayor Adams is not here. But we need to follow through with our good intentions. And every time we put money here, I'd like to see lessons learned as a sort of, hey, let's take this opportunity to put a little bit of this money toward a long-term environmental solution and equity solution and have these sort of parameters that every project we undertake with these millions and billions of dollars that we've got other alternative projects underway too, and we can monitor them very carefully and make sure that we have the numbers. Yeah, 30% is not cool. It's definitely not cool, and I say that as an Oregon tradeswoman.
Can I just comment, because I don't want to lose this moment, and say that I think that what Crystal Linsky has just said is perhaps the most important comment on this subject that I've ever heard, and for two reasons. One is that we're currently being sued as a city for using green technology to address this problem. So I appreciate you calling out that we should be looking for cost-effective ways of harnessing nature to address sewage and stormwater overflow. But you should know we are subject of currently of a lawsuit, a well-funded lawsuit that challenges our practices. And the second thing is, you've made an eloquent point about equity. And I would just also observe that my reading of the proposed water district that we will be debating over the next 5 months, nowhere in there does it say that the new water district would be bound by any of the city's equity goals. As a separate legal entity, they would determine how contracting would be done and what standards. So you've raised two fundamental questions that we ought to be thinking about as we talk about these issues going forward, and I appreciate your eloquence.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Okay. Time for a roll call.
Novick.
Aye.
Fritz.
Aye.
Fish.
Aye.
Hales.
Good work. Aye. Thank you. All right. Now, I believe we have one more regular item.
Two more regular items.
Sorry, 1158. Second reading. Roll call.
Amend utility license law to adjust rate for water and sewer utility license fees.
Roll call, please.
Novick.
Aye.
Fritz.
Aye.
Fish.
I want to take just a second to compliment a investigative journalist named Steve Law, who wrote a piece the day after we had our hearing last week, which I thought was particularly thoughtful, and he gave the whole context and some of the texture of this debate that's currently online at the Portland Tribune. And if someone is interested in this issue of utility license fees and the city's practice of charging public and private utilities, and in particular, the move to have a consistent rate that applies to both, I think Steve's second article published the day after last week's debate was particularly thoughtful. Aye.
Hales.
Facts are always one of the options. Aye. Okay. Now, one more regular item, 1159.
Authorized price agreements with Harper Hoof Peterson Regalis, Inc. and T.Y. Lynn International for construction, inspection, and technical support services for a total not to exceed the amount of $1.5 million each.
Mr. Novick.
Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Todd Lyles with the Portland Bureau of Transportation. On August 7th, PBOT received 8 proposals in response to our RFP to supply construction, inspection, and engineering support services. The proposals were reviewed, evaluated, and scored by a 5-person evaluation committee, including a representative from the Minority Evaluator Program. The resulting scores from the initial evaluation did not produce clear winners, but allowed a short list of 4 firms to be selected to move on to the second round in the interview process. On October 11th, shortlist interviews were conducted, and the 4 firms were again evaluated and scored using the same RFP criteria by the evaluation committee. Harper Hoff Peterson Regalis and T.Y. Lynn International were selected as the highest scoring proposals. The Bureau of Transportation is recommending the Council authorize 3-year price agreements to Harper Hoff Peterson Regalis and T.Y. Lynn International for a not to exceed amount of $1.5 million each. The resulting contracts will supply personnel services for federally funded projects only. Because of federal funding, the City of Portland is required to follow the federal DBE guidelines stated in 49 CFR Chapter 26. Federal guidelines do not allow the city to use its corporate responsibility, RFP criteria, or allocate points for MWESB utilization. ODOT has the responsibility, through an agreement with FHWA, to administer the certified consultant selection process for local public agencies. PBOT must adhere to this ODOT-FHWA-approved program in order to continue to receive reimbursement on federally funded projects. Recently, a separate RFP was issued earlier in April for non-federally funded construction, inspection, and engineering support services in which the city did use its corporate responsibility criteria as part of the evaluation and scoring process, which had its MWESB criteria in it. Okay? So in this new contract for inspection technical services, HHPR has proposed to use 4 state-certified subcontracted firms, Cooper Zeitz Engineers, which is an MBE and DBE, Convergent Pacific, which is a DBE, MBE, and ESB, KE and Associates, which is a WBE, ESB, and DBE, and Buckland and Associates, which is a WBE, ESB, and DBE. T.Y. Lynn has proposed to use 2 state-certified firms, Eastwind Consulting, which is a WBE, ESB, and DBE, and Cooper Zeitz, which is, again, an MBE and DBE. And lastly, federal projects get assigned DBE goals when they go to construction. It's important to note that while MWESB percentages are not enforced in this contract, the DB goals are.
Thank you, Mr. Lyles. And again, the purpose of these contracts is to supply qualified temporary personnel for construction services when internal staff aren't available due to high volume of projects going to construction. And we've been using contracts like this, PBOT has, since the 1990s. Historically, 1 consultant performed this work, but we're giving a second firm the opportunity to gain this experience.
Good. Thank you. Good report. Thanks.
Thank you.
Anyone signed up on this item?
No one signed up.
Great. Passes to second reading. Okay, and now we can take up the items that were pulled from consent, please.
Item 1149, authorized grant agreement with VAWS Workers Rights Education Project for $25,000 to operate and maintain their Portland Day labor hire site.
Who pulled that?
And Lightning pulled that.
Okay. Do you want to speak on this item?
I believe there's someone else who wants to speak on it.
Come on up.
Your problem.
Go ahead.
Good morning.
My name is Lightning. I represent Portland Lightning Think Tank. Basically, on this subject, I absolutely agree with the grant being given. One of the things I'd like to maybe propose is that maybe even down the line, add an additional $5,000 to VAWS Workers' Right Education Project. And what I'd like to maybe see is them conduct a study on maybe implementing their program into maybe facilities such as the Bud Clark Commons, and maybe even Portland Rescue Mission, and utilizing their space. And why I say that is that I think it would be a great relationship due to the fact we have a tremendous amount of people in those locations looking for work. And if we could have this set up in those locations also and utilize the workforce and not just reduce homelessness, but also create jobs and look at it in that manner, and having a workforce in line where you have people already lined up and getting them back out in working jobs. So basically, that's all I had to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Good. Charles?
Buenos tardes, alcalde. Mi nombre es Charles Johnson. I believe you have a representative here from Portland VOES, but since this did get pulled, I do want to say that where their administrative offices are at St. Francis Church, they do excellent work along with their day labor center, and I hope that the city, after it approves this grant, I know you're going to all vote for in favor, but after you approve this, that you'll continue to find the resources to work with VOES. Other day labor services have problems dealing with racial diversity and language diversity, so this is an important program to keep going in our community, and if the economic recovery continues, I hope you'll even consider that some additional funding may go there. Although I hope they can do better to also get better under the equity lens. We'd like to see more ladies be able to work at VOES too.
Thanks. Afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Rain Fisiatoro, and I'm the development director with VOES. Workers.
Big shoes to fill.
Yeah. So I want to thank City Hall for having this in the agenda, and I just want to start off by saying two numbers: 19,000 and 300,000. 19,000, which probably will by the end of this year be 20,000, are the amount of jobs we were able to connect the unemployed individuals at the VOES Worker Center. 300,000 is the number of day laborers or unemployed individuals through our wage claim services have been able to reclaim their wages, who've been victims of wage theft. So that has been the impact that we've had in the community. And those are just two numbers. The most important thing about VOES is that the people who come and use our services. Now, the people who come and use our services are not just the Latino community. They're not just the immigrant community. But it's a much more diverse community. The face of VOES is changing and evolving. And the people who come and use our services, like these two gentlemen presented, there is a need. And that need is growing. And VOES is filling that need. So I want to thank City Hall, as you guys will probably pass this ordinance, for being a partner with VOES. But also being a partner with a community that really that needs this kind of service. And as we look into the future, VOES is being has a vision to be more inclusive, working with a broader community, which is one of the things we're taking on right now as the face of VOES is changing, as I'm explaining right now. But we want to continue to have this relationship with the City Hall, and we continually hope that City Hall will be part of this vision as VOES continually works to bring in help from different community partners to ensure that there are jobs for the unemployed and day laborers. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, further discussion? And welcome. Oh, Crystal, come on.
Thank you. Thanks for getting this on the agenda.
quickly so we could hear a couple good voices. My name is Crystal Lelinski. I forgot to mention a couple things from the last agenda item. I meant to mention Graywater.
Because we got to deal with it.
Graywater, okay. The second one is very important, and it's related to this. I've had some of the best days of my life at VOS, and it started, I was involved when they started with the Reed College students teaching English on the streets near where I was working at the time. And